welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Hello to episode 122. This is our penultimate episode of 2023. Next week, our Physicians Weekly board member, Dr. Alex McDonald, will join me and we'll talk about the top 10 medical news items, the breakthroughs of 2023. So be sure and tune in. But today we're going to kick off the lively discussion with Professor E. David Crawford about why is the prostate serum antigen or PSA test controversial for screening? The National Cancer Institute describes the PSA test as follows, quote, using the PSA test to screen men for prostate cancer is controversial because it is not yet known for certain whether this test actually saves lives, end quote. We turn to Dr. Crawford, who's a professor of urology at UC San Diego and also head of the section of urological oncology at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, and he's an advocate for early detection of prostate cancer. For our second interview this week, we are joined again by our regular contributor, Dr. Medlow, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney, and this time she's going to discuss when the doctor and the insurance disagree about settling a case. While many doctors may express a desire to go to trial in the face of a malpractice lawsuit, seeking vindication and clearing their name, of course, the reality is that the majority of these cases do settle out of court. On the other hand, a doctor who is eager to put the matter behind them may feel pressured into settling. So, how does a doctor navigate the situation when they find themselves at odds with their insurance company over the decision to settle? Enjoy listening.
Hello, my name is Marta Kelly, and I'm here today with Dr. E. David Crawford. He is currently serving as professor of urology at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, and is an emeritus distinguished endowed professor of surgery, urology, and radiation oncology and head of the section of urologic oncology at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Oh, that's a mouthful. Anyway, welcome and thank you for doing the interview today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. This is an extremely important topic.
And that's my first question. What makes this an important topic? What is the importance of increased in prostate cancer calls for screening line revamp?
Sure. What makes this important is the actual numbers, the statistics, and the impact. Prostate cancer in 1989 became the most common cancer diagnosed in American males and the second leading cause of death. And that was a challenge. And so what do you do with this? At that time, most cases that walked into the doctor's office were advanced prostate cancer. People had back pain, urinary problems, things like that. So what do you do? Three things, I think. You try to prevent it. That's one strategy. Second strategy is find it early, treat it, and cure it. And the third strategy is to attempt to cure the advanced disease stages. And so, for the last three decades, basically, we have been sort of wading our way through all of this, just focusing on prevention. We've looked at a lot of different things, vitamins, selenium, vitamin E, and so forth, but nothing really has worked. It doesn't stand out there. What we know is what's prostate healthy is heart healthy, so a good diet and exercise. Advanced disease, a lot of progress has been made in treating advanced prostate cancer, but we still don't cure it. We control it, and there are side effects. So that leaves us with the thing we use with a lot of cancers is finding it early, treating it, and curing it. And that's where we were been for the last three decades in prostate cancer. But what happened is we've got a great test. PSA is one of the best markers in oncology, and it is a test that helps us identify who's at risk for prostate cancer. The problem is, and here's where it all backfired, is that PSA elevations are not just due to prostate cancer, but size of the prostate. And as men get older, they get a bigger prostate. And the other thing that exists is if a man lives long enough, he's going to have prostate cancer. And if you look at 70-year-old men, if you go take 100 of them off the street and pick the prostates out and look at it, you'll find that maybe 60% of them have prostate cancer, but we don't want to find it. That's the problem. We want to find the ones that are at risk. And so there's where the problem began We started out, we impacted advanced disease. We saw it plummet. And then what happened was we got a little over-aggressive and over-treated a lot of men, leading to guidelines being changed. And the biggest ones were the U.S. Services Preventive Tests, where they don't screen for prostate cancer. We know it that it's helpful, but it does more harm than good. And that's where we are right now, is what's the next steps? Because what's happened is advanced prostate cancer has crept back in, and it is a bad disease. Two reasons. One is screening. We're not doing it so much anymore. And then the other thing, everything gets blamed on COVID. And in fact, that is one of the issues that happened here. So we're faced with that today.
How do the current guidelines miss early diagnosis possibilities?
Well, you know, we need to get our act together here, quite honestly, physicians and organizations. It's one of those things that if every objection's overcome, nothing's ever accomplished. And there are all sorts of guidelines, all sorts of feelings about it. PSA is a great test. I look at it as throwing out a net. We want to catch the big fish, which is the high-grade prostate cancers, the ones that result in nearly 40,000 men dying a year. And we want to let the little fish go. And that's the low-grade prostate cancers or elevated PSA. So what do we do? And you think about it, Google what a normal blood pressure is, and you'll get something back like 130 over 70, 140 over 90. Google what PSA levels are. Well, you'll get about 20 pages of different explanations. And so we have to come to a consensus about what's a good cutoff for PSA. And we studied that over 10 years ago, published on it, and 1.5 was a good cutoff. Some people agree with it, some don't, and there's, you know, that's the problem. Okay, I don't care if it's 2, 1, things like that, but we've got to have something that's straightforward, that's easy to remember for family practice doctors, who are the ones that see these patients. All right, so the other big thing is I went to see my family practice doctor in the summer for my annual physical, and he said, we're not going to do a PSA on you because of your age. I go, wait a minute. And you're talking to the wrong person here about this. And what they handed me a piece of paper. It's sort of told all the bad things about screening. I don't disagree with it, but it didn't talk about the positive things. And the positive things are we were cutting down an advanced disease. So what's new? I mean, where are we going with this? First of all, we've got to get our acts together on a consensus about what PSA is. A great marker. We just have to have some number that we can use. The problem is if you have numbers related to age, to where you live and all this race and one thing after another, it gets very confusing. You just need, you know, 140 over 90 blood pressure or something. So what we have now is if a PSA is elevated, it used to be that men just went, they've got a biopsy. And, you know, that we were doing 1.2 million biopsies in the United States each year. And that's not, there are a couple hundred thousand prostate cancer cases a year, 250,000 or so. So we're doing a lot of biopsies who are negative. So what do we have now? When you go see your doctor, your medical doctor, and your blood sugar is elevated, what do? They don't start you on insulin right away. They don't start you on metformin. They do an A1C hemoglobin. And we need an A1C hemoglobin for prostate cancer. When you have an abnormal EKG, they don't rush you off and do a bypass. They study your vessels. Well, if you have an abnormal PSA, and I would say that 1.5 and above is sort of a danger zone, Then, by the way, so I don't forget this, 73% of men have a PSA of less than 1.5 if you grab them off the street. All right, so what do you do next? You do your A1C hemoglobin. We have markers, molecular markers, that are done in urine, blood, and other things that say, hey, this PSA elevation is probably related to the risk of a significant prostate cancer. And it's an important thing that happens that gives us the next step. But then again, we get into every objection's overcome, nothing's ever accomplished. Where there's so many different tests out there that we hear about, the urine test and blood test, and arguments about them and things like that. We need to make it clear. And the family practice doctors who see an order, 90% of the PSAs in the United States are confused. And so you can understand why they say, hey, we're not going to screen. But, you know, they, in the heart of hearts, I think most of them know, and we all know, that finding the disease early and the right person makes a difference.
Well, that kind of leads into my next question about what would you like to see urologists incorporate into their practices?
Well, I think urologists are believers in early detection, but sometimes they are not making the right decisions on whom to biopsy and about different treatment options. And we're seeing that change, but we have to have an acceptable PSA cutoff that we use. We have to reflex or something and do another a molecular marker if somebody has minimal elevation of their PSA. And then the other thing that's out there is that, and we've been doing this for over 10 years now. I had men come in to see me over the years and say, hey, Dr. Crawford, you know, my wife has a breast cancer and they're not taking her whole breast off. They're just doing a lumpectomy with radiation sometimes and things like that. And why can't she do that to my prostate? Why can't she just take care of the area that's involved? And that we used to say, oh, it's all over. We don't know where it is and things like that. We're getting better at finding out where the lesions are. And almost 40 to 50% of men that we find may be candidates for just treating the cancer and not the whole prostate. So therefore, you can cut down to some of the side effects. But we've got to, again, there's a lot of controversy about all of this, and there's not always a clear way forward. If you're someone that has a special radiation machine, guess what you're going to recommend? If you're one, a person that has a robot for surgery or this, guess what you're going to get recommended many times? So I think that we have to have multidisciplinary approach. This is a team approach for prostate cancer, that you get second opinions on your biopsies, that you get talk to radiation oncologists, to urologists and others, and make an informed decision about which way to go. But to hand a piece of paper to somebody and say, hey, we're not going to screen because of all these factors. Let's try to overcome the factors. Let's get our act together. And that's what I hope we can do.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very informative.
Hello, and welcome back to Physicians Weekly. We are joined again by our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney. This time to discuss when the doctor and the insurer disagree about settling a case. Dr. Medlaw, thank you again for being with us.
Great to be here.
Most doctors will usually say that if they are sued for malpractice, that they want to go to trial because they want vindication. But the majority of cases actually settle. Then, on the other hand, a doctor who needs to put the case behind them may feel pushed into a trial. How does a doctor deal with the situation in which they disagree with their insurer over whether to settle?
Well, you just noted this can go two ways. Doctors who think that they could have prevailed at trial and avoided having a malpractice loss on their record are left feeling that their concerns were relevant to the insurer. And on the flip side, doctors who have a lot of personal risk if a case is tried because the award could exceed their policy limits or a significant loss could trigger a limitation on their license or their privileges or lose their job, they don't want to be pushed into a trial.
Starting with the first situation, doctors look to a consent to settle clause in their insurance contract as a safety net. Is this realistic?
I'm going to give you a lawyerly answer. Maybe. Malpractice insurance covers defense as well as indemnification for payment, but the insurer is the one setting the operational terms, and a consent to settle clause is subject to that as well. So it's not the significant control that its name would suggest.
So you are saying that there can be a conflict of interest?
Absolutely. The doctor has a personal agenda that they feel entitled to have honored, but the insurer just wants to spend the least to end the matter. So the critical point in this is that when there is a conflict, it's the insurer that's in the stronger position.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in cases in which doctors have sued their insurers to stop a settlement, courts have largely deferred to the insurers.
Why?
Well, they start with the public policy that efficient settlement is favored over protracted litigation. And then they look at what is really the limited scope of the insurer's duty. It has to provide defense and indemnification, but it has no obligation to protect the doctor from negative consequences like increased costs or damage to their reputation.
But what if the insurer is really acting unfairly to the doctor?
It would have to be pretty egregious, you know, basically not even meeting the minimum standard to be a defender and an indemnifier. So, for examples of insurer conduct that courts have found was serious enough to bar a settlement were things like, you know, just offering a settlement without really even investigating the claim, or entering into a settlement that blocked the doctor from bringing their own valid counterclaim, or, this was really a bad case, settling with some of the plaintiffs for the total amount of the policy, leaving the doctor personally on the hook for any payments to everybody else. A doctor should, however, assume that unless their insurer is, you know, really undermining them, that its choice to settle will be held to be within its power.
So where does a consent to settle clause come in?
Well, a consent to settle clause generally states that an insurer must not settle a claim without receiving the consent of the insured, and that's what the doctor wants. But it will also state that that consent shall not be unreasonably withheld.
But what does unreasonably mean?
It means what the insurer says it means. And that brings us back to the courts deferring to the insurer. Now, the doctor may feel that it's entirely reasonable to refuse settlement because that will trigger a license restriction. But under the general principle that they're only entitled to a limitation of financial loss in the actual case, their opposition to a settlement that frankly does save that money would be held to be not reasonable. And wait, it can be worse.
How so?
Well, the contract of insurance probably also contains what is colloquially called a hammer clause. Why is it called that? Not in the nice way of handsome Thor with Mjolnir. It's because it's punitive.
What does that do?
It will specify that if the doctor declines to settle, that they will be personally responsible for all additional expenses. That means the award and defense costs. If the case ends up costing more than it would have cost to settle it at the level that the insurer recommended.
But what if that total is still within policy limits?
It won't matter. Under a hammer clause, the total coverage would now be limited to the level of the settlement that the insurer wanted accepted. And the insured doctor would no longer have access to the full value of the policy that they purchased and they've been paying on for years. So what will usually happen is that the doctor will be afraid to roll those dice and they will agree to settle. Now, all of that awfulness having been said, most insurers will work with their insured doctors. It's just necessary to keep in mind that a bare consent to settle clause actually only has as much meaning as the insurer wants it to have.
Are there other options?
Well, there are two variations on the consent to settle clause that that can be better. The first is pure consent. That actually gives the doctor the full power to stop the insurer from acting without their agreement. And there's also co-insurance. It's sometimes called a modified hammer clause. And under this, the doctor and the insurer split the amount by which an eventual outcome on a case that the doctor refused to settle exceeds the costs of the case had it settled. The critical point there is to look at, you know, what that percentage split is in terms of how much each has to cover. The downside is that having either of these will raise the premium pretty significantly. There's also the possibility to go to another forum.
What does that entail?
Well, one choice is binding arbitration. If you and the insurer really cannot agree on whether to settle the case, the matter goes to an arbitrator. This gives the doctor the chance to, you know, really present their arguments against settlement fully to a third party without having to slog through litigation. to set off there is the choice of the arbitrator. You don't want the insurer to be able to pick them on their own. You also want to make sure that there are fair and effective rules, like the rules of the American Arbitration Association, that are going to be applied. The other option is a physician panel. And of course, you know, who actually sits on that panel therefore matters a great deal. So you want to check on the selection rules carefully. Now, these are also going to be more expensive to include in the policy, but they do give leverage. If you are going to go for something extra like these, you want to make sure that you really get the protection bang for those extra bucks. So you're going to want to have the contract of insurance reviewed by an experienced attorney before you take that step.
So these issues were about when the doctor does not want to settle. What if they do?
Well, that goes to what we call bad faith lawsuits. Now, a bad faith claim against an insurer is one that alleges that the insurer is trying to renege on its obligations. They typically actually come up in the medical setting when it's the patient who's suing their health insurance carrier over their refusal to cover care that really should be covered under the contract of insurance. In the setting of a defendant doctor in a malpractice case suing their insurer, the claim would be that the insurer should be offering settlement to end the case promptly and within policy limits, rather than subjecting the doctor to the risk of a trial that they could lose and an award that could exceed the policy's coverage and that they would have to cover themselves.
So is this a breach of contract claim?
It is an aspect of that, but it's really alleging that the very basis of the insurance relationship is breached because the insurer is prioritizing its own interests above its obligation to the insured doctor.
But didn't you say that courts defer to insurers on how they manage a case, even though they are factoring in their own business risk?
Yes, but here the allegation would be that they're doing so to the degree that they're just ignoring their obligation to the doctor's interests. And that's not permissible. So the way that a court will look at the issue is that because the doctor has surrendered control over handling of the case against them to the insurer, that the insurer now has a good faith duty to act in lieu of the doctor, basically as the doctor would. They have to consider whether an eventual award could exceed policy limits, even though they won't be paying those extra fees, the doctor will. And they have to give fair consideration to a reasonable settlement offer. And they have to actually settle when a reasonably prudent person who was themselves paying out the claim would settle. And this is actually easier for the doctor to address than opposing a settlement is.
Why is that?
Well, that is because the doctor objecting to a settlement is talking about these personal ancillary issues that the insurer really doesn't have to consider. But in a lawsuit over a failure to settle, a doctor left with a bill that they're personally liable for now because settlement was rejected, well, they've clearly been damaged in a way that insurance was actually supposed to protect them from.
So are these cases only brought when the original malpractice case is over?
It can be brought during the primary case, but it's usually done after an unfavorable outcome because that avoids the judicial reluctance to intrude on the insurer's discretion in an ongoing case. And it frankly allows the doctor to point at this accrued damage, this real number that they're stuck with now.
In the first section, we talked about the hammer clause to discourage opposition to settlement. Is there a way that the insurer will try to block a case that is insisting on settlement?
Oh, yes. They're insurers. They write the contracts. They will add a clause in the contract of insurance that says that they can investigate and settle a claim as they, and I'm doing air quotes, deems expedient. And they will say, well, this put the doctor on notice that we have the exclusive authority to control settlement and, frankly, to consider our own interests. When the doctor then signs that insurance contract, they're then held to have consented to that. And if they do sue, the insurer is going to hold this up and say, we're moving to dismiss the lawsuit because, hey, the doctor agreed. Now, of course, a lawsuit should really only be a final resort.
What else can the doctor do?
It would frankly be preferable to first engage private counsel and have them interact with that recalcitrant insurer on your behalf. It's often remarkable how a lawyer gets attention that a mere insured doctor does not.
Dr. Medlaw, thank you again for being with us.
And thanks for the chance to talk about these important topics.
That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you listen in next week, too. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly. Physicians Weekly offers in-depth interviews with the most highly respected experts in the medical community. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.